This is The Guardian.
Hey, Michael Safi here.
And I'm Helen Pitt from The Guardian's Today in Focus podcast.
Now, with campaigns from the Democrats and Republicans in full swing, the eyes of the world are turning to the US.
And Today in Focus is going to be in America with deep dives from the swing states every week.
Plus, there'll be a daily update from me, Lucy Hoff, bringing you the latest news from the campaign trail in this pivotal race to the White House.
Join us for Today in Focus every weekday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We have to be honest. Honest about the fact that we made mistakes. Honest about the fact that we let standards slip. The time has come to tell the truth.
How do you like my garbage truck? This truck is in honor of Kamala and Joe Biden.
What do we always say? Keep Kamala and carry on along.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
We're sitting here on a Monday morning at Westminster, Kieran, where in spite of being thousands of miles away, the big story obviously overshadowing everything this week is the US election on Tuesday. And we'll come to that in a moment. First, we should talk about what happened on Saturday, which was that Kemi Badenoch was announced as the new leader of the Conservatives, the official opposition, beating Robert Jenrick in a vote of party members with 56%. So actually much closer than previous contests. And in her victory speech, she promised to bring back the voters that the party lost in July when they lost the election to Labour, and to change this country by changing the way that government works. We're not quite sure what that means yet, but we'll soon find out, I'm sure. And in July, the party was trounced. It ended up with just 121 seats. That does feel like a lifetime ago, though, doesn't it? Kemi Badenoch was one of the front runners then, but did you expect her to win?
Yeah, I did. I think that consistently polls told us that she was the favourite of the Tory membership. And it felt like throughout the race that the only way to stop her winning would be to not let her go through to the final round of two. So there was a moment just after Tory conference where I thought, oh, maybe the final two will actually be James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick. And, you know, they'll find a way to make sure she doesn't go through to that final two. And I suspect, you know, some of Robert Jenrick's supporters may have been trying to make that happen, may have been, I don't know if there was vote lending going on to James Cleverly or what, but obviously there was a lot of people trying to back the candidate they thought their candidate could beat. But no, once we knew that it was Robert Jenrick versus Kemi Badenoch, it felt like the polls were telling us that she was ahead. It also felt like she was ahead because I think we mentioned this before, he was the one taking risks. He was doing a lot of media appearances. He was making policy announcements. He was getting out there, getting his voice heard. And she, if anything, was kind of ducking some of that. And that usually tells you who feels like they're ahead.
Yeah, she was very much sort of the high risk and high reward candidate, wasn't she, throughout? And I think, you know, now that she has won, it feels before she can even get on to the Conservative office of the country, she needs to do two things. And one of those is try to unite her fractured party. And I mean, that is much easier said than done. But when you consider that only a third of Tory MPs actually backed her to be party leader, and 54% of Tory members that voted, actually it was nearer 40% of all Tory members supported her, that's not going to be an easy task. And we've seen how disgruntled, disillusioned, dismayed Tory MPs have brought down leader after leader after leader. They've changed the rules this time around to make it slightly harder for her to face a vote of no confidence from MPs. But, you know, it's hard to imagine a time where the Tory psychodrama doesn't continue. So that will be her first challenge. And then the second challenge is that before she even sets out what she wants to do with the Conservative Party, she obviously talked about going back to first principles and doing policy reviews and so on. She needs to be able to acknowledge what went wrong at the general election, because actually the people she needs to speak to are not her own members. The people she needs to speak to are the country, the public more broadly, who rejected the Conservatives so resoundingly at the election and aren't really, it doesn't seem to be, despite some disappointment being picked up in focus groups and polling towards Labour, they're not yet ready to be won over again by the Conservatives. Not enough time has passed, not enough change has happened, and not enough sort of reflection on what went wrong and why the electorate rejected them has taken place. So she has to do those two things first, really, doesn't she?
Yeah, well, if that's her first task, admitting what went wrong and admitting the mistakes of the past, she's off to a bad start, because her first major media appearance after winning the contest was on the Sunday political shows, and she said that, well, she basically downplayed Partygate and suggested that it was less of a big deal than people had thought. And maybe in the course of time, we'll all look back and think of this as a relatively minor scandal. That's the kind of message that goes down well with Tory members. It's not the kind of message that goes down well with the wider electorate. If that is going to be her first task, she's going to have to shift quite rapidly onto admitting some of those mistakes. She is not, I would say, characteristically somebody who tends to admit mistakes. So let's see whether she can kind of inject an element of humility into to her pitch to the voters.
Well, as you mentioned, her character, she's going to be the party's sixth leader in 9 years. And she's seen as being quite unpredictable, a bit irascible, a bit pugilistic, maybe. Tory MPs, well, I know they were really worried during the contest about this. Do you think they're still worried?
Yeah, they're definitely worried. They're definitely worried. I mean, I think that there is a sense of excitement along with the nerves, I would say. They think that she could be quite an effective leader of the opposition. People I talk to, in both parties, actually, Tories and Labour Party, say that it'll be really interesting watching her at Prime Minister's Questions. And she'll cut a very different figure from Rishi Sunak, who kind of is cerebral and actually often has quite downbeat persona when it comes to Prime Minister's Questions. She is going to be on the offensive all the time, attacking. And she'll be somebody that Labour don't quite know how to go after. She's a bit of an unknown quantity. She's obviously a black woman, and that kind of poses its own challenges. You know, you don't want to look as Keir Starmer, a middle-aged white man, like you're kind of hectoring or bullying, Kemi Badenoch as a much younger black woman. I think that kind of brings its own dynamic to it. But yeah, I think that they, you know, the party is still nervous, because what she will do is she'll pick some fights where she can win and where she'll really land bruises on Labour. And she will pick some fights that turn out to be blind alleys and that she should never have gone down.
And we saw examples of that during the last Tory conference, where she ended up embroiled in a fight about statutory maternity pay, which she had suggested, whether it's misspeaking or not, we don't know, that it was too high. And there's that nervousness over her sort of making throwaway comments and then not being able to kind of backtrack from them, but doubling down on them instead. That's not the only example. Allied with the fact that while she has a very strong reputation amongst gender critical women on the equality debate, that is still an incredibly divisive debate. Mm-hmm. And that's just one example of a whole series of areas that some people call culture wars, that you can imagine her being really punchy with Labour and causing problems, because it will get talked about, because what she does, I think, manage to do is to cut through. Yeah. She kind of gets a hearing. Yeah. All the focus groups suggest that people are prepared to, they don't know much about her, but they want to hear what she's got to say. She sounds fresh and authentic. You know, whether they see the sort of the side to her that we hear about at Westminster, where she can be really rude, where she's faced bullying allegations in the past, where she can be very dismissive and patronising of people in the chamber and out with, remains to be seen. But I think there was some acknowledgement in the final days of the campaign that from her team that they know that she needs to kind of treat people properly. because she won't get them on side. She won't be able to win over those Tory MPs that are anxious about her unless she does.
Yeah, and I think it's more than just her character. I think it is her views as well. And I am told that she has a lot of other views that we haven't actually had a chance to ask her about yet, but which could definitely trip her up in the years to come. And I think part of the problem with that answer that she gave on maternity pay was not that it was a slip of the tongue. I think that's what she believes. Mm. I think she probably does believe that maternity leave is overly burdensome on business. And to that extent, you know, she has some quite old school libertarian views. I think it's up to, you know, what Labour will try and do over the next few years is pick away at each of those. Because the thing is with her, she does have these views and she is unwilling to resile from them. So if she is going to own her views and be the authentic leader that she says she's going to be and that she has proven so far, there's just going to be so many rows about things that don't necessarily mm-hmm. matter very much, but don't put her on the side of the voters.
And particularly because she hasn't yet nailed her policy colours to the mast and is planning, presumably, to do a series of reviews, David Cameron style, and when he took over in 2005, you know, a series of reviews, which could take a couple of years to try and work out what the party's policy is going to be. So there's a lot for us to learn from all of that. But it does suggest that the Tories might just be a talking shop for a couple of years. But despite that, there's a couple of big decisions coming up that they'll have to make. Things like, for example, what they're going to do about the budget. Now, Kemi Badenoch was on the telly on Sunday, and she was suggesting that she was aware with 121 MPs they couldn't defeat the government on legislation, but they can still put down a marker. And on something like the budget, which crystallised and more sort of sharply defined what this Labour government actually stands for, it creates a dividing line between them and the Conservatives, you know, big state, small state, on the side of the workers rather than employers, on the side of broken public sector rather than private interests, all those things. It is a moment, really, that she needs to put down a marker for, and for the public to know where the Conservative Party lie on all of that.
Right. And I think sometimes you can get a little bit too clever political about this. But, you know, one thing that is often said for a new leader coming in is, some point fairly early on, you should pick a fight with your party just to show the voters that you're on their side rather than the party side. And I wonder whether it would be quite good politics for her to take a bold stance in support of one of the government's budget measures, even if it means alienating parts of her own party. For example, she could choose to do that on inheritance tax. It would be quite a good idea politically for her to say, look, we do have to fix the public finances. I'm going to back this measure and I'm going to have a loud public fight with my own party about it.
And for people not automatically to say, oh, it's the same old Tories.
Yeah.
Before we move on, we should just talk very quickly about what Kemi Badenoch's doing today. She's going to be addressing staff at CCHQ. Later on in the week, she'll be addressing the Conservative backbenchers. But before that, she has to appoint her shadow cabinet, and she's already announced that Rebecca Harris, who is a long-standing whip, not a well-known name inside Westminster, let alone outside Westminster, is going to be a chief whip. Now, she's already been appointed because she's going to be by Badenoch's side as she appoints that shadow cabinet. She knows, you know, who can be relied on, who's loyal, where the bodies are buried, all that sort of thing, and will help her make the decisions. And we know that Dominic Johnson, Lord Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg's business partner and former trade minister, and Nigel Huddleston, who worked with Kemi Badenoch in the Department for Business and Trade, will be the joint Tory chairs. There's also names like Andrew Griffith, Laura Trott, Claire Coutinho, all ministers in the former government getting senior roles. Potentially shadow chancellor for Andrew Griffith. We know that Laura Trott and Claire Coutinho are close friends of Badenoch, are likely to be rewarded. And then some others who were part of the infamous evil plotters WhatsApp group, Julia Lopez, Alex Burkhart, and so on, likely to get parliamentary roles, and others like Lee Rowley, another former MP, potentially something like chief of staff. One name which jumped out to me in reports over the weekend, which I thought was very interesting, was the prospect of Ben Howshin, the Tees Valley mayor, being deputy leader. But we're told this morning that the suggestions that Badenoch had asked him to take on that major role, obviously he'd be based in the House of Lords as well, he's based in the House of Lords as well, were slightly premature.
Can I just, on Ben Howshin, one thing, if Badenoch doesn't last the full 5 years, keep an eye on Ben Howshin, because I think he is a Tory leader in waiting.
From the House of Lords. Slightly problematic,
well,
but there's ways of getting around it, aren't there?
We've seen it with... There's ways of, you know, putting your peerage to one side and running for office.
Well, Tony Benn.
Exactly.
and others since as well. Okay, so where most of the attention is going to be this week is, of course, the other side of the Atlantic, where voters will be choosing between the Democrat Kamala Harris and Republican Donald Trump. And while we're not going to know the outcome for several days, Kieran, polls are showing already that both candidates are neck and neck. I mean, it's going to be really close, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, even though most people are saying it could take several days for the results to come through, it might be that come Wednesday morning, we do actually have a sense of who's won. It won't take much for the polls to be quite seriously wrong, because essentially all the polls are saying it's absolutely neck and neck, 2 points either way, and you'll know, oh, goodness me, okay, that's the way the polls were wrong. Now we can forecast. And, you know, we'll talk about polls, but there was obviously a very dramatic poll over the weekend from Iowa, where Ann Seltzer showed Harris ahead, despite that not being a swing state, and Trump in every other poll being massively ahead. If we start to see that kind of result coming through, if Kamala Harris wins Iowa, then we'll know very quickly who's going to be president. So we might know. We might just know by Wednesday morning. Mm-hmm.
And if Kamala Harris wins, she's more of a known quantity as a Democrat, and a Democrat that's served as vice president for the last 4 years to the Labour Party. And while Keir Starmer hasn't actually met her, we think we would expect him to prioritise a trip to the White House to meet her should she win. He does, and Labour does, have very good, close, deep, strong links with the Democratic Party across the board, including, of course, with David Lammy, the foreign secretary who, you know, knows everyone from Barack Obama down. Donald Trump, however, is a bit more of a challenge, shall we say. But it's one that Keir Starmer came into power fully aware of and has made a huge effort to build relationships with Donald Trump, because he believes, Starmer believes, that personal relationships are sort of the foundation stone of all international relations. And we saw back in July, after that first assassination attempt on Donald Trump, at the advice of the US ambassador, the British ambassador in the US, Karen Pierce, Keir Starmer not just write a note of consolation to Donald Trump, but actually pick up the phone and speak to him. And that was seen as being a real moment amongst the Republicans that sort of indicated what sort of relationship they could have in future. Add to that things like David Lammy reaching out to J.D. Vance, the VP candidate, and also the dinner that both Lammy and Starmer had with Donald Trump in Trump Tower when he was over for the UN General Assembly in September, which apparently was, you know, very dominated by the politics. Trump was apparently really interested in what had happened in Britain in the so-called Red Wall, presumably seeing a parallel with the Rust Belt states. And the British side came away from thinking that actually they could work together, and that even though Trump felt, well, rightly, that Starmer and Starmer's Labour were on the liberal end of the spectrum, that he felt that he could do deals with them. And as we all know, Donald Trump's a deal maker.
I think that Downing Street could fall into a trap here, which is to think that they're building a great rapport with Donald Trump, and therefore that's going to see them through some rough patches. Yes, Keir Starmer, I think, did well to get on the phone with him after the assassination attempt. Apparently, by all accounts, they had this chummy dinner. But Donald Trump and Keir Starmer, first of all, are completely different in their characters. Donald Trump is impetuous. He's quite warm in person, I think, in a way that Keir Starmer is not. But he's liable to be swayed by a lot of other things, whereas Keir Starmer kind of stays doggedly to one course. I think as soon as the first little incident comes up in their personal relationship, they're going to find very quickly that warmth drains. And we've already seen it, you know, with the controversy over Labour sending people over to help campaign for the Kamala Harris campaign. That caused serious problems with the Republicans, even if Donald Trump was friendly afterwards. I think another trap is to think that, oh, you know, Donald Trump really loves us because we just won the election. He's very interested in our win and how we got into the Red Wall. Yes, that is true. Donald Trump loves winners. But as soon as Donald Trump starts paying attention to what's happened to Labour's rating afterwards, mm-hmm. and the Tories will be in his ear about this.
And not just that, Nigel Farage will be in his ear.
Nigel Farage will be in his ear as well. He will very quickly think, oh, maybe this guy isn't a winner. Maybe he's a loser. And there's nothing worse in Donald Trump's world than to be a loser. Look, there's not much that Keir Starmer can do about those two things. They're just going to happen. What they have to do is really keep Trump's mind, I think, focused on the deal-making aspect that you mentioned. That's where people who don't necessarily get on with him, who maybe even aren't respected by him, can make headway in Washington under Trump by showing him a path for him to be seen as the great deal maker and the puppet master in geopolitics.
So there's obviously a couple of big issues which will be firmly on Starmer and number 10's agenda. Should Trump win? I mean, actually, even if he doesn't, but it's the Democrats, but specifically if he does. And they are global security. So crucially, Ukraine. Of course, Donald Trump has said that he wants there to be a peace deal. We expect there to be attempts at a peace deal between Kyiv and Moscow, regardless of who wins the US election. But it's quite clear that Trump is not going to offer the sort of support to Ukraine and President Zelensky that President Biden did. And that could be problematic both in terms of the money and the sort of financial support, but also military and security support, encouraging Ukraine potentially at some point to join NATO and so on. So that's going to be problematic for them. China as well, the overlap between trade and security. Donald Trump is fiercely protectionist when it comes to trade policy. Possibly an opportunity for Britain if they can sort of step up the rhetoric but do business sort of below the headlines, as it were. British prime ministers always try and push for, you know, a free trade agreement with the states, and they have repeatedly failed, mainly because they want, understandably, to have as close relationships as possible. Well, Starmer will want as close relationships as possible with the EU on things like agriculture and trade. And therefore, that means that an FTA, full FTA, is out the window because it would contravene what the US would demand in return. But there are potentially some opportunities for smaller deals on specific sectors like economic security and tech. But certainly lots for number 10 and the British Embassy in Washington to go over should we get to the point of Trump winning. But before that, Kieran, tell us what you'll be watching for with the voting.
Well, look, I mean, we are now 36 hours away from polls closing, so it won't be long before we actually start to get results. But I think it's just interesting for British poll watchers to know what to watch for. One thing I would say is look at state polls rather than national polls. Often, you know, you get pollsters who are very specialist in certain states and they can get those results quite accurate. The second is when you're watching for what's happening with the early voting, just bear in mind how many people have voted there and what the normal pattern of voting. One of the most interesting things that's happened in this election campaign is that it has completely flipped in terms of who is voting by mail and who is not. So in the last election, Democrats voted by mail, Republicans didn't really, partially because Donald Trump was telling them not to. This time around, the Republicans have got themselves sorted out and told their supporters to vote by mail. So what you're seeing is in a lot of states, a big surge in Republican ballots coming in. And we don't know how those people have voted. What we do know is if they're registered Republicans or not. So what we're seeing is tons of ballots coming in by registered Republicans, building up leads apparently in certain key swing states, which is going to make life much tougher for Democrats. One place I am watching almost by the hour at the moment is Nevada, because Nevada is not only a swing state, but it's a state where there is a huge amount of postal voting. In fact, you might get kind of 80% of people voting by mail. There is a man called John Ralston at the Nevada Independent who runs an early voting blog, which I highly recommend to listeners because he is brilliant at picking apart the numbers and saying, look, what you've got here is a big surge in rural voting from Nevada. Those Trump people are turning out. They're turning out at the moment more than the registered Democrats are, which is slightly worrying. There is also a big independent vote. And there are some polls this weekend which have suggested, and some Democrats are saying this, that the independents are breaking quite heavily towards Kamala Harris. So maybe that's the group that is going to decide this election one way or another. But for Democrats reading those early voting numbers in Nevada, I'd be quite nervous.
Now, as we mentioned before, one of the first big decisions that Kimmy Badenoch is going to have to make is whether or not the Tories will back the budget. So let's go back to domestic politics for a moment. And there was reports over the weekend, still 6 days on from the budget, with briefings from unhappy business leaders, farmers, public sector workers, and so on. Yet the conversations I've had in recent days with Labour people, you know, in Downing Street, in government and with MPs, is actually more one of relief that they, despite all the build up to the budget and all this sort of fear about what it could bring for the public, that the sort of the initial reactions from people seems to be, oh, it wasn't actually as bad as I thought it was going to be. And in fact, Starmer's pretty dismal personal ratings are not quite so dismal in the aftermath. And as I mentioned earlier, what I think this budget has really done has crystallised what this Labour government's about. On one level, it was a very traditional Labour budget. No surprise, given that they'd won such a big election victory, perhaps. But given some of the language that we heard from Starmer and others in the run-up to the election and in the aftermath, things like the investment summit, talking about wealth creation and business and so on, as well as workers' rights, they've picked a side, right? They've picked the side of working people rather than businesses. They picked, as I said, the side of public services rather than private interests. Whereas they could have gone down the route of more austerity when it came to public services, they picked the side of tax and spend and, of course, borrowing. And so far, that appears to be sort of had the sign off by, you know, the big international financial institutions. It was a difficult inheritance on many levels. And I think lots of Labour people right now thinking, well, of course, there's going to be some grumblings in the right-wing press, but actually, this has gone pretty much as well as we could have hoped.
Yeah, well, I was talking to Labour MPs and officials on Friday, and I wrote a piece in Saturday's Guardian just talking about how they had responded to it. And the dominant theme was, well, at least we know what we're about now. At least we have something to defend. And I think there was a feeling that in the early days of this government, you know, Labour MPs just didn't know what to go out and tell voters. Now they do. Now there's a message. There's a clear narrative for this government. Now, it might turn out to be horrendously unpopular and backfire on them. But at least for Labour MPs, they know which side they have chosen. And they've chosen to fund public services rather than cutting taxes. That's a choice.
And what we've heard a lot from the opposition, the Conservatives and Reform and other opposition parties, is that Labour's broken promises. They're focusing, of course, on that national insurance rise for employers, not employees. Again, Labour picking their side, which they say is in breach of Labour's manifesto promise not to put up taxes for working people. Now, we've been over this countless times in recent weeks, so let's not replay the arguments here. But it could have an impact on whether voters think that Starmer is not going to keep his promises. The one thing I'd say that people in Downing Street are currently relying on is the fact that we're only 3 months in to a long Labour government. You know, they've got time to show voters that they will deliver on their promises in their manifesto. They've got time to deliver other budgets, which Reeve said over the weekend would not be tax-raising budgets in the way that this one has been. I mean, you can't entirely rule that out, obviously, but that's certainly their intention right now, they say. So time is on their side. And I think because of that, they will be quite happy with the way that this has landed.
I think if I was them, the thing I'd be more nervous about actually is a graph in the OBR's forecasts, which showed this was on course to be the second worst parliament for personal incomes in history. Mm. The last parliament having been the worst.
Living standards, yeah.
Living standards are not forecast to improve very much by the end of this parliament. Now, public services might, and that's their hope. But people do tend to vote depending on how well off they feel. And They're not going to feel much better off on current forecasts than they did at the last election.
Well, I think that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris will be back later this week. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Mit Asana ist KI nicht mehr nur ein Tool, sondern ein Teammitglied. Jetzt hilft Asana AI Ihnen, Ihre Ziele besser zu erreichen und verknüpft sie mit relevanten Projekten, damit alles planmäßig verläuft. So arbeiten Ihre Teams intelligenter und schneller. Asana, die führende Plattform für KI-gestütztes Workmanagement. Jetzt kostenlos testen auf asana.com. asana.com.